Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We're trying to connect up with Kyle Gilmore, Port Nola Director of Real Estate, and we'll get to him as soon as we're able to do so. Just want to remind everyone, it's today is your last chance to win tickets to Sunday's Saints battle with San Francisco in the Caesars Superdome. You can score two premium tickets to the game, plus a pair of VIP tailgate passes from Bullseye Event Group. We're talking open bar with premium liquor, all-you-can-eat buffet from celebrity chef Aaron May, all overlooking Champion Square. Winning is easy. Go to WWL.com/contests and enter today. Your final chance to win Saints 49ers tickets from Saints Radio WWL. And Mike Dettillier and Steve Geller for weekend kickoff, a special edition of Sports Talk from the Treasure Chest Casino today and every Thursday. Come and hang out with them. Great grub, gambling, and get amped up for LSU's matchup with the Florida Gators and Saints battle with the San Francisco 49ers and Thursday night football. So you get to meet up with Mike Dettillier, Steve Geller, at the Treasure Chest Casino by the Game Bar and Grill today from 4 to 7. It's always a good time. Heard folks have been out there and they always enjoy themselves. I'm sorry, Coleman? Okay. All right. We've got Kyle Gilmore now, Port Nola Director of Real Estate. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, Kyle, I've really enjoyed talking with you folks from the port, especially because in many sense we've made this educational about all that the port is responsible for, and we'll do some more of that today. You manage the real estate. I don't think people really understand the scale of the port, so let's start there. Can you give us, you know, a sense of the scale?
Sure, and I think it's, you know, it's interesting that you ask that question. Whenever I tell folks I'm the director of real estate at the port, they sort of look at me a little shocked because they don't understand what the port owns as far as real estate assets. So I think most people think of the extent of the port's property as what we refer to as the terminal, which is uptown in New Orleans, essentially between, you know, the Walmart on Chapultepec and Children's Hospital uptown. But the port is actually one of the larger landholders in the area. So we have a diverse portfolio of properties across Orleans, Jefferson, and St. Bernard Parish, totaling about 2,500 acres. So in addition to the terminal, we control a majority of the property along the Industrial Canal. So, you know, whenever you travel over the high rise, if you look left or right, you'll see our properties and the operations that are taking place there. We have, you know, some aggregate storage, some cement transloading, cold storage. It's a very diverse group of companies. Additionally, the port has property along the Gulf Intercoastal Waterway. We have industrial warehouse space in Elmwood and riverfront property not on the terminal that's used for both landside and waterside activities. And last but not least, we also manage property owned by the New Orleans Public Belt. They have property here in Orleans and in Jefferson Parish as well. And the connection to the public belt allows our property to be the essentially the front door to the gateway, which opens up the rest of the country by having our rail service connected to all six of the Class 1 railways, something that no other port in the country can claim. So there's definitely plenty to keep us business here on the real estate side of things.
Yeah, and I guess the beauty from an operational perspective of having control over the rail is it's totally within your purview and control, so you get to set the pace and everything else. You're not having to rely on a third party, right?
Correct. So, you know, we have the New Orleans Public Belt was acquired by the port in 2018 with a deal from the city of New Orleans. They got some property from us, and we took over the railroad. But, yeah, along with the actual railroad comes that expertise. you know, and those connections to the rail lines. So it allows us the option to offer our tenants or our partners the opportunity to use the rail line. You know, when we have properties that one of our tenants or our operators want to expand into the rail space, we have that expertise on hand that can help them plan that out logistically as well as on the engineering side to make sure that those plans make sense for their operations.
So when we talk about each of these individual areas, that, like in the industrial real estate, why is that such an important part of the port's overall mission?
Yeah, so the port's mission, as you mentioned, is essentially to facilitate the movement of cargo in an effort to improve the economic well-being of the region. So that's the main goal of the port. And I think one thing that is important for folks that are listening to understand is that the Port of New Orleans is what we're calling a landlord port as opposed to an operating port. So as in any traditional real estate transaction, the port's properties are leased to tenants, and those leases are governed by leases, obviously. However, port tenants are all companies who contribute in some way to the movement of cargo. So the men and women that come to work at the port on a daily basis to move, unload, ship and store cargo are not actually employees of the port. So they're employed by our port tenants. So not only are the industrial real estate leases generating revenue for the port, they also facilitate the opportunity for auxiliary businesses and services that employ a lot of folks in the state and beyond. I believe it's generally accepted that approximately 1 in 20 jobs in the state are connected in some way to the Port of New Orleans and the cargo that is moved through the gateway. So the industrial real estate really provides a foundation for a lot of the economic impact that happens through the port.
Yeah. Now, we've talked on this show and about the LIT project in the Louisiana International Terminal. Mm-hmm. The port actually owns property in St. Bernard, right? And are those properties going to be utilized for purposes of the LIT?
Yeah, so we have about 1,100 acres of property down in St. Bernard Parish. As I'm sure your listeners know that the Louisiana International Terminal Project is a large container port that we're planning on building down there. The container port itself is not going to utilize the entire 1,100 acres. It'll use about 400 of those 1,100 acres, so there'll be several hundred acres left over for planning of additional services that may be used by our tenants or our operators. Things like containerized cargo, transloading, transshipping, things like that, and as well as like distribution warehouses, anything that's going to go along with the container operations that are going to be on that facility.
And why this is relevant, all of this, is because we need to stay competitive. Others are improving upon their port facilities, dock facilities, cranes, and, you know, moving everything along. Obviously, I guess with the onslaught of AI, mm-hmm. Even faster changes along that path, right?
Yeah, so certainly. So, you know, our competitors in Texas and Alabama, they're receiving a lot of investment in their port facilities. I think the one thing that hinders us here at the Port of New Orleans is there's a physical constraint that, you know, most people don't face, and it's the Mississippi River Bridge. So as containerized cargo, which is the preferred method these days, becomes more pervasive throughout the industry, shippers are adapting and building larger vessels to carry more containers, but unfortunately those newer vessels just are unable to pass beneath the bridge, which means those vessels and all the cargo that's heading this way is now being diverted to other places, so they're skipping New Orleans. So it's critical that we develop the Louisiana International Terminal in order to just stay competitive in the market.
Now, you talked earlier about how a lot of third parties are the ones that are actually operating certain functions and alike on port property. Mm-hmm. I have to imagine that y'all do have openings at points in time. And are there any type of tenants that you're proactively looking for?
Yeah, so we're constantly getting calls from people interested in port property. We do have, you know, a lot of property that is available if people are interested. We'll listen to anybody. And I think it's important to note, you know, we're a state agency. While we are the Port of New Orleans, there are multiple other ports in the area, in the southern Mississippi River area. So, you know, we want to improve the economy for the entire state, not just the Port of New Orleans. So if somebody comes to us with an idea that doesn't really make sense for the Port of New Orleans, we always direct them to one of our partners. But the type of tenants we're most interested in seeing at the port are 3PLs, which are third-party logistic companies that are focused on repackaging and transloading. And I think we're well positioned for groups that focus on fresh cold storage, like fruits, vegetables, even flowers. We do a lot of work with bulk liquid importers and exporters and some light manufacturing. So most of these services already exist in the area, but they're limited. So whenever we get new players in the market, we're always interested in hearing what they bring to the market to make more services available to our partners.
Now, going back to something that you said before, relative to the public belt and having control over that, those linkages to six tier one rail services, I believe. For the benefit of a listening audience, describe why that is so important to this port.
Yeah, so there are six Class One railroads that span the entire country and into Canada. You know, the big names we've all heard of, Norfolk Southern, Union Pacific, et cetera. Our connectivity to all six of those Class One railroads allows the port to offer those services to our tenants and partners to move cargo from New Orleans to anywhere in the country in one step. It cuts down on costs and makes the process more efficient. So instead of having to unload it from a vessel, put it on a truck, send it somewhere, put it on a rail, et cetera, they can literally take it from a vessel here in the Mississippi River, put it on a rail, and ship it to anywhere else in the country or beyond. And from a real estate standpoint, as I mentioned earlier, we have an advantage because not only do we have the connectivity, we also have that expertise in-house. For example, we're working with one of our tenants now, Continental Cement, who deals in bulk cement. You know, they see more opportunity in their line of business, so they're adding new rail lines to their site, which will allow them to capture more of a market because they're expanding their services not just through the trucks but through rail. So they're able to get more accounts in different areas because they now have that rail connectivity. So it provides just another service that the port can offer its tenants where those – you know, the ability to use all six Class One railroads just doesn't exist in any other port.
Yeah. So when you look at all of the port operations, you know, both this industrial real estate that you're managing and all of the logistics, the warehousing, do you see any, like, significant trends emerging that are going to be, you know, something that are transformational for the port?
Well, you know, we're in volatile times as far as international shipping is concerned. You know, one of the things we do a lot of is cold storage. A lot of poultry moves through the Port of New Orleans and goes out to South America and West Africa. Unfortunately, we're seeing that market cool off a little bit, no pun intended. But there's still a demand for fresh cold storage, as I mentioned earlier. So we're seeing that as something we can capitalize on. A lot of the fruits, vegetables, and flowers that we'd like to capture are grown in Central and South America, and our positioning adjacent to that area makes us a really good choice for that. You know, once the LIT is up and running, we're expecting to see a huge demand for warehouse space. You know, we're expecting probably about 15 million square feet of warehouse spaces being needed. Wow. In Orleans, St. Bernard, and St. Tammany Parish over the next 10 years, with an emphasis on rail-served properties, so that, you know, the rail keeps popping into all these conversations. You know, we don't really foresee e-commerce slowing down, so that's something we're interested in as far as distribution centers are concerned. And we're keeping an eye on some of these things like same-day delivery and some of these new delivery methods via, you know, drones and robots and what that means for our business moving forward. So all in all, we're keeping an eye on things, but, you know, everything seems to be trending upward as far as warehousing, logistics, and cold storage are concerned. So we're excited about all that.
Absolutely. Exciting times for the Port of New Orleans. Kyle Gilmore, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate backfilling a lot of the magnitude of the port, which is 2,500 acres of prime industrial real estate is absolutely incredible. Best of luck to you, and have a great weekend.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Kyle Gilmore, Port NOLA Director of Real Estate. We'll be right back, folks. And when we do, we'll check in with Patrick Button, Associate Professor of Economics at Tulane University. Can taxing the rich fix the budget deficit in the U.S.? We'll tackle that question and more when we return.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. So there's this vexing question about can taxing the rich fix the budget deficit in the United States? And as Bernie Sanders and AOC make their way around the country on their Tax the Rich tour, I came across this article that was written by an economist from the Manhattan Institute that is in captions, here's what would happen if we seized all the wealth from America's 800 billionaires, and what would happen? Joining us is Patrick Button, associate professor of economics at Tulane University. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Patrick, I found this article somewhat intriguing about if we just stripped away everything they have, what would it actually mean? And this economist says it wouldn't mean much as it relates to dealing with the deficits that we're racking up with the U.S. budget. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I mostly agree with you there. I think the problem is pretty severe. So to give the larger picture, the deficit right now is about $1.8 trillion. That means that the government, federal government spends more than $1.8 trillion more than it brings in. And if we compare the current debt that we have to our gross domestic product, which is the amount of, you know, action in the economy, the debt to GDP ratio is 123%. So if the federal government and the entire country were to like put all of its money towards the debt, it would take us 1 year and 3 months to try to pay off the entire debt that we have. So it's a pretty big issue that we're facing right now. So it's absolutely the case that all these proposals would not, you know, solve this issue. And I don't think most people agree that that's the case. It will help a lot, but we need to do a lot of different things, both cutting expenditures, cutting spending, and also increasing taxes in order to wrestle with this big deficit problem.
So the author of the article says if you took everything from the 800 billionaires, it's not going to eliminate it. In fact, it would only finance the federal government for 9 months for 1 year, not 9 months out of every year. So it's a one-time deal, right? And then they're gone. And if you took 100% of the marginal tax rates for millionaires in the country, it doesn't do a whole lot more because there just simply aren't that many, right?
Yeah. So from the same article from Manhattan Institute, if we were to enact all of these different sort of broadly tax-rich proposals that could be increasing top income tax brackets, that could be increasing capital gains, closing tax loopholes, raising corporate tax rates. You know, if we were to do all those things, that would at best provide 2% of the GDP in terms of tax revenue, right? That would make a significant dent in the debt-to-GDP ratio, but it would not solve the entire thing. So I think that it still is a lot of money that could be extremely useful. And absolutely, the only way we can resolve this would be to do some of these proposals, but there's no way that they're going to resolve the entire problem.
But isn't one of the problems, and I think, you know, as I listened the other day to a presentation put on by Bernie Sanders and AOC, they never talk about what downstream implications or negative implications are when you begin to raise tax rates on individuals, you know, who are otherwise nimble and can pretty much go wherever they want, and they will, in order to shelter as much of their income as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's sort of missing from a lot of these, you know, stump speeches and whatnot, is sort of what is the, what we call distortionary effect of taxes, right? And it depends on the tax. That's why we have to be strategic about which taxes do we want to cut, which taxes do we want to raise. For example, corporate tax rates can really affect investment behavior. And so some economists are more wary of increasing corporate taxes. However, one proposal to increase taxes, which doesn't have as much of a negative effect, would be to raise income taxes, especially at top income brackets, where workability is sort of less sensitive to the income tax rate. So every tax is discretionary. It just sort of depends on how much. And so we have to dig into the details.
When we talk about, and in the article, there's a breakdown of American taxes are highly progressive. Your thoughts about what was laid out in that section, and if you would, explain that for the listening audience.
Yeah, that's great. So progressive taxes means, and most countries have progressive taxes, that means that, for example, there's higher income tax rates for those who have higher incomes. So you may face a marginal higher income tax rate, so maybe you're paying 30% in taxes if you have very high incomes compared to 10% in taxes, or even you're actually getting tax credits at lower income. So every country has that. United States is fairly typical. I'd say one difference is that for the better or for worse, I think maybe for better, United States actually has very low tax rates for very low incomes. So families sort of near the poverty line oftentimes pay little taxes, or sometimes they get tax credits, such as the earned income tax credit, which is used to sort of reduce poverty and encourage work. So that's why, you know, the article talks about the U.S. having a more progressive system. That's because the tax rates at the very lowest rungs of the economic ladder are very low, which I think is probably good for reducing poverty.
So when you settle that, and what, you know, again, a lot of people don't really understand how much of this actually goes to financing a government. I love when they break it down and they said the top earned 20% actually fund government for 201 days out of the 365. The next 20% fund 41 days, and the bottom earning 60% of Americans, which means the U.S. population, including the median earners, funded the federal government for just 21 days of the year. So the sum total of what they pay, it covers 21 days of expenses of the federal government. And it kind of lays it out where you see who's predominantly funding and financing government today, right?
Right, absolutely. So I think it's absolutely the case that those with higher incomes are absolutely paying more. I don't think that's under question whatsoever. But we have to kind of think strategically about, you know, those questions of fairness, but also a question of impacts, right? So if we were to increase taxes on lower income families, that's going to have more of an impact than, say, those at higher income families. And certainly those higher income families are paying proportionately more, right? But I think we have to kind of keep in account, like, how taxes indirectly affect each type of family, I think, is sort of one of the larger things that are here. And so there's no sort of winning strategy, but I think we have to be really careful about thinking about who's going to be most impacted by taxes if we were to raise those, or who's going to be most impacted by spending cuts or spending increases.
So when we compare ourselves to European countries, right, and AOC and Bernie have been doing this as well, but they only give really half the picture. I was just in Croatia at the beginning of the summer. They had, like, I think it was a 23% value-added tax, a sales tax, a national sales tax. And, you know, you have some national sales taxes that are as high as 27, 30% in some European countries. But they don't talk about that at all. And that's why, you know, they're able to fund and finance some of the social programs that they have, whether it's medicine, this, that, or otherwise. Because they had this whole other tax. And by the way, that other tax is not progressive, right? It's regressive.
It's progressive, Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's funny because, yeah, sales taxes aren't really discussed much in any of these proposals, probably because I think there is a hesitancy to use those because they are really regressive, meaning that those with lower incomes are paying more of that. So, you know, if you're, you know, you have to pay, you know, 5% tax on every single purchase you make, you know, at a grocery store, like that adds up more for lower income families. And so there's some hesitancy to use that tax because it's so aggressive.
And the interesting thing is that those value-added taxes in those countries are providing a significant percentage of GDP with those. And a lot of those countries are a lot like New Orleans, right? They're heavily reliant on tourism. In fact, in Croatia, the number one industry in Croatia is tourism. And, you know, the number one generator of income for the government is that value-added tax. You know, and then in within the cities, there's an additional 2 or 3%. I think they try to make sure that they all stay below 5%, but you could be paying as much as 26% in value-added tax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think generally in Europe, there's more of that value-added tax, but then there's also tends to be one compensating mechanism, which is sort of more of a social welfare system that would then provide additional income to those families that are disproportionately paying more of that tax, right? So typically when you increase those taxes, you have to think about what are ways that we can minimize the impact on lower-income families. And so European countries generally tend to have more of those policies that would compensate some of the regressive impacts of that tax.
Yeah, but, you know, I think the point you're making, they highlight the benefit that they're getting, but they're not highlighting how much they're actually paying in VAT tax in order to be able to enjoy that benefit.
And, right. Certainly the narrative is not complete whatsoever. I mean, people aren't like talking like, gosh, we're trying to get into the weeds of this. People are sort of talking about, oh, generally it's going to raise a bunch of money and there's not as much discussion about how or exactly how much. Right. And so that's why we have to fill in the details.
Yeah, I just find it very misleading because, you know, I have people ask me because I was the former tax collector in Jefferson Parish. And they're like, well, this is how it happens in Europe. And I'm like, no, that's not how it happens in Europe. So they're paying your middle income wage earners and your lower income wage earners, because of the regressive nature of the value added tax, they're paying a much larger proportion of taxes than in the United States. They get benefits, yes, but they're paying for them in one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a lot of details missing. I think, you know, to get a handle on this deficit issue, this debt issue, you know, I think it requires a lot of strategies around, you know, increasing tax revenue and decreasing expenditures. And that's where you have to get into the nitty gritty of what are we spending on what. Like, for example, we spend the same amount on Medicare as we do a national defense, which is $874 billion, just as an example, right? And so we have to have these difficult questions about, like, which tax levers do we move up and down, you know, which spending levers we move up and down. And it's kind of hard to communicate all of that if you're doing just some speech.
I think Clinton was the last president to balance the budget. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, I just looked at that. Yeah, because we saw the deficit really explode starting about 2001, which is the dot-com bubble recession. So after 2001 onwards, we've seen, under all presidents, generally speaking, the deficit growing. So, yeah, you're exactly right.
And, you know, when we think about a clip of 1.4 to 1.8 trillion a year that we're adding, you know, whatever that number is, and they're saying that, you know, based on some calculations that are coming up, it could get as high as 3.4 trillion. We don't really, I mean, even with all the proposals, we would have to get to crazy, crazy tax rates to turn the tide if we're going to be above $3 trillion. That we're adding to the deficit every year.
Yeah, so definitely tax reform is not going to solve this issue. So increasing taxes is not going to fully resolve this issue. It's going to be something to be chipped away at the long term, both with increasing tax revenue and then also decreasing expenditures. So both things have to happen.
And then when we think about how much of the budget is just tied up with defense, Medicare, Medicaid?
Yeah, so So Medicare, just Medicare on its own, not like Medicaid or other health programs, is $874 billion, which is the same amount of spending for national defense. The largest expenditure is Social Security, so it's going to be retirement benefit, disability insurance. That's $1.4 trillion. Second big expenditure is health, not including Medicaid, not including Medicare, so including Medicaid, Children's Health Insurance Program, Center for Disease Control, NIH, things like that, is just under $1 trillion. So there's quite a few, you know, like large pockets of expenditure that would have to be looked at. And that's where we have to be really strategic about, like, what do we value as a nation? You know, cutting things is not great, right? But, like, what are the things that are sort of less crucial, right?
Yeah, so it's can it be done?
That's a great question. I mean, it's a pretty big issue. I think we did see significant progress on this, you know, during Clinton and sort of prior presidents, right? I'm hoping that we can sort of at least try to, you know, decrease the trend, because if we keep increasing the deficit, increasing the debt, which is what we're seeing of the current president and previous president happen too, then we're going to be paying more and more in what we call net interest. So the third largest expenditure for the federal government is net interest. So we pay $880 billion of interest payments on our debt. So it's the third largest expenditure, just a little bit more than we spend on Medicare, a little bit more than we spend on national defense. And so that amount that we pay is going to keep growing unless we try to shrink that. But I think, you know, if we can think strategically, we can try to shrink that gradually. But yeah, I can't tell if that's something that we can resolve. I think with the current political climate, I'm skeptical.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that the old adage that the federal government can just print money. Yes, it can, but it's at a cost, right? It's not.
Absolutely.
It's not free.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people out there that think it's just free. It's not.
I wish it were that simple.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Patrick Budden, Associate Professor of Economics at Tulane University. Truly appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Breaking news. Southern University campus placed on lockdown. Students told to shelter in place. We'll try to get more information for you when we return.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
So the net effect of the article in our conversation with Patrick Button, Associate Professor of Economics at Tulane University, it's not an argument against increasing some of the taxes on the rich. It's just that trying to fix this deficit problem that we find ourselves in is going to have to do more, because the mathematical reality, the author points out, is that the budget deficits have grown so enormous that the tax the rich policies can't close more than a tiny fraction of these deficits. And they say also that much of Europe long ago learned the hard way when they went overboard on wealth taxes and steep top income and corporate tax brackets that can backfire on economy. And that's why their non-VAT tax codes have moved back closer to ours. What happened was they left. They went to another country. They set up shop somewhere else, corporate headquarters in other places, with more favorable tax rates. They didn't have to be, like, for example, in France. They could move to Belgium. The Belgians didn't like it much because they were gobbling up all the valuable property, overpaying, but still it made sense for them. And certainly we want to stabilize the debt. However, what they're not telling you is that the only way that it's really going to happen is if the middle class taxes will rise, unless federal spending is significantly pared back. And because of the staggering amount of money that's tied up in both Social Security and Medicare, it is literally almost impossible for that not to be touched. Now, we know that that is political suicide. We've talked about that a million times on this show. But what I don't like about what's happening with AOC and Bernie Sanders on their Tax the Rich tour is they're telling half the story. And they're getting people to believe that this is the panacea solution. And once that happens, we don't have to talk about this issue any longer. And that's just not true, because it's not. And unless we're able to rein in spending around here and figure out exactly how we go about doing that, this plan is not going to work. And it's going to be a similar conversation that we're going to have shortly in the next segment with the folks from BGR about the fact that the city of New Orleans financially is at a tipping point. And there's going to have to be a priority base and a priority set and a construct adopted and adhered to with no exceptions or otherwise. We're going to look a lot like the federal government. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Today at 4 o'clock, you can join Mike Dettillier and Steve Geller for weekend kickoff at Treasure Chest Casino. Saints legend Drew Brees phones in at 4:40 to talk about the Black and Gold's Week 2 showdown with San Francisco. Plus, we'll take a look at LSU and other top college matchups with CBS Sports analyst Danny Cannell at 5:20. And also, we'll get the lowdown on Florida coming to Tiger Stadium from Locked On Gators host Brandon Olson at 6:10. And you can join Mike, Steve, and Charlie's for Pick 6, their top NFL and college selections at 6:30. And then at 7, Thursday Night Football. Washington Commanders at the Green Bay Packers on WWL and the Odyssey app. When we come back after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Stephen Stewart, Vice President and Research Director of BGR, and Paul Rue, Research Analyst at BGR. Is the city of New Orleans at a tipping point financially? The budget is on pace for over $100 million shortfall, with new costs looming in 2026 and beyond. Just how bad is this? We'll talk about that and more when we return, so stay with us. This is Newell on WWL.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.